over this Christmas break, my brother sends me a text and says, hey, do you remember Astar the robot? And I was like, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. And he's like, really? How can you not remember Astar the robot? It was such a critical part of our childhood. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then he sent me this video. See if you remember. Anyone remember that? First of all, I would have loved to have been in the marketing meeting where they came up with this concept, right? Like, we need something to help kids play safe, and some guy at the back, I got an idea. Go with me on this. Creepy robot playing in a factory jungle of saws and blades, gets his arm cut off, then tells kids to play safe. Brilliant, run with it. It's like, what? That is the most bizarre ever. That was what growing up in the 80s was like, for those of you who weren't around then, just weird stuff like that. But he sent it to me, and I still was like, I have no recollection of this. And he's like, how can you not remember Astar the Robot? But I'm like, I don't know. For the life of me, I couldn't recall ever having seen this commercial, ever heard of this guy, despite my brother insisting this was like a staple growing up for us. And it reminds me that memory is such a fickle friend. And there's much to both, I think, celebrate and abhor about memory. It can deceive us or escape us right when we need it most. On many days, our memory won't even allow us to remember where we placed our phone or glasses. It never seems, though, at the same time, to ever let us forget the painful, harmful, or humiliating aspects of life. Seems to keep those memories readily available. But memory, beyond regular frustrations we have with it, I think collectively too now, we're dealing with the prospect of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. It looms large, I think, on our collective consciousness. Because the more we become aware of its horrors, the prospect of a life that's dominated by catastrophic forgetting seems downright terrifying. And it makes to me the curiosity of memory all the more intriguing, because as fickle as memory can be, as devastating as it can be, we desperately need it for lots of things, lots of daily things, like remembering the content of conversations or the names of friends, the foods we like, or the 347 passwords you need to just be on the internet today. Like, if you go into your computer, you need a password to get into the thing that reminds you of your other passwords. There's so many passwords today, I can't follow it. We need memory, but on a deeper level, our memory represents to us our connection to the past and our very selves. Without it, we would not be us. And so this morning, I want to explore the phenomenon we know as memory. And for me, it's not just the sort of cursory interest. It goes beyond the realm of a simple curiosity, because you see, Jesus asked his followers to remember one thing in particular. He asked those who would follow his path to remember his cross, that event, through the symbols of bread and wine. Luke 22 records it this way. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I'll not eat it again until it finds its fulfillment in the kingdom of God. And after taking the cup, he gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among you. For I tell you, I'll not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took the bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. All of the gospel stories relate this event, this scene, in some sort of way. But what is clear is that Jesus thought remembering this one event was important. And I want to get to that next Sunday, actually. I want to spend some time unpacking that. But for this morning, what intrigues me is the idea that Jesus wanted us to remember one thing. And yet, you move into the New Testament, you come to this church in Corinth, and it seems that this community forgot rather quickly the meaning and significance of this cross event. The one thing they were asked to remember, it becomes distorted within a generation. Here's how Paul addresses them in their act of remembering the cross. In the following directives, I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good. So then when you come together, it's not the Lord's supper you eat, for when you're eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers. As a result, one person remains hungry, another gets drunk. Don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? Certainly not in this matter. For I received from the Lord what I passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread. When he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." And so for this early Christian community, something had gone wrong. Something had gone off course. And Paul's like, we need to correct this. Their memory had failed. Memory of Jesus' cross event, the implications of that memory had been distorted and forgotten to the point that it was humiliating for some people. And so they forgot and distorted the one thing. And as a result, you work the way through 1 Corinthians, you realize there's ugly chaos going on in this community. And as I've thought about this, I've thought, I can't help but think that what we're witnessing in the broader church today is that same storyline playing out. Church forgetting the one thing. The church forgetting the cross and all that it means. And as a result, we look at the wider church today and it feels like it's in ugly chaos. And so my thought this morning was this: perhaps if we understood the nature of memory more fully, maybe it would help us appreciate why Jesus thought remembering this one thing was important, and maybe it would also help us understand why churches so often forget it. Because I think the importance of memory to us as a species, even as a church, is this: our memories shape our sense of identity by drawing from the past to inform our present and future trajectory. In a sense, our memories, how we remember, it defines us. If you mar memories, your identity and trajectory will follow. That's why memory's important. And I'm very fascinated with the rise of things like Ancestry.com, people trying to look into their lineage, their past, trying to connect with some sort of ancestral memory. I know for our family, I don't really have extended family, and they're all in Nova Scotia, and we're not connected with them all. It sometimes feels very much like we're just on our own, have no connection to the past. My brothers and I have been doing some research lately. Like, well, like, where are we from as a family? Who are we? And we're of Scottish origin. The Watson clan wasn't big enough to kind of have their own tribe, so to speak, but we've narrowed it down to, we can see this place in Scotland where apparently Watsons used to live and be. And as part of our research, we found the Watson clan crest and motto, which I find fascinating. It's this: Inspireta floruit, which means flourishing unexpectedly. Which about sums up who I am, right? Like, hey, I'm not doing bad. I know it's unexpected, but I just feel like, wow, that's like setting the bar really low. Most Scottish clans, it's like courage and honor at all costs. Us, I know you didn't think we'd do well, but we're not doing too bad. Oh, well, that's who we are. Apparently where we came from. And it's interesting to me because we want to sort of, our memories, they define us in a way. And if you mar your past, your identity and trajectory follow. The problem is, especially on a personal level, memory is incredibly fragile and malleable. Brian Resnick says this about personal memories: though they may appear crystal clear in our minds, our memories are not a carbon copy of the events we witnessed. Every time we recall a memory, we may accidentally alter it or diminish its accuracy. Most frustrating of all, we change these details and reconstruct with that reality without being aware we're doing it. and the seams of our edited memories are silently sealed. We often can't remember what we can't remember. Or as psychologist Julia Shaw says, every memory you've ever had is full of distortions and errors. That's a little unsettling. And of course, this has huge implications for justice, for psychology, of course, for identity, personally or communally. I also think it has implications for the church. His memory is key. Jesus wants us to remember one thing, but if memory can get distorted and is prone to error, well, that's problematic. And I want to explore that because I think for the Corinthian church, this is the root of what's going on with their problem. They failed to remember well. And failure of memory is often linked to two things. And what I want to explore next Sunday is how these two things relate to the cross event, to the church. But it's often related to two things. I want to explore them on their own this morning. They're these: transience, the forgetting that occurs with the passage of time, and malleability, that our memories are vulnerable to error and change, especially when there's outside influences. Let's start with transience, the forgetting that occurs with the passage of time. Take, for example, the conclusion of the most publicized trial in, I think, all of human history. A jury acquits O.J. Simpson of murder. Now, when this happened, word of the verdict spread quickly, right? If I'm recalling correctly, I believe they wheeled a TV into our classroom for this, I think. But then again, who knows? If you were alive during this time, though, that was all people were talking about. For weeks, for months, it seemed like. It's the kind of momentous event that you sort of have seared into your brain. The question is, can you recall where you were when you heard O.J. Simpson was acquitted? I'm sure many of us can probably conjure up some sort of image, but what memory research is telling us is that you're probably wrong, or at least partially wrong. You see, what research did after this event, a number of big events in history, is they had a group of undergraduate students describe 3 days later exactly where they were when they heard the acquittal of O.J. Simpson. And then they tested them 15 months later, and only 50% of that group was able to recall exactly how their day had happened. It was filled with distortions. 3 years later, that number had dropped to 30%. This is true of all major events, JFK assassination, 9/11. People forget over time. The culprit is transience, forgetting that occurs with the passage of time. It's the curse of memory. Particulars fade. And as I was thinking about this, I actually realized I had a distortion in my own story about 9/11. For years, I've been telling it, I woke up to go to class Tuesday morning, turned on the TV, saw what was happening, and then basically didn't leave my TV for like 2 weeks, right? Like just zoom. But then when I started thinking, maybe my mind's messed up, I went looking and I realized that in the fall of 2001, I didn't have a class on Tuesday mornings. So I'm still left going, I have no idea why I was up or why I turned on the TV. I just know I got up, turned on the TV, there it was. But for years I'd been telling it, I had to go to class, that's why I got up. That wasn't in fact the case. It's fascinating to me. Or how many of you have listened to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, his episode, right, on Free Brian Williams is absolutely fascinating. If you want a primer on memory, that's a great episode to listen to. He talks about the story of Brian Williams, famous news anchor for MSNBC. And Brian Williams had been telling a story as a war correspondent in Iraq. He was in a helicopter. Helicopters ahead of him were fired upon, so they were forced to land because they were in a dangerous area. But over the years, the story becomes bigger, to the point where he appears on the David Letterman show 10 years later. He tells the story, and his story has morphed into his helicopter was fired upon, forcing them to land. When he told this story, outrage ensued. Like, what, you're trying to make yourself look like a hero? He was fired, forced to grovel publicly, admit he was wrong. He was forced to admit he was looking for attention. But the thing we miss is this is just how memory goes. This is what Malcolm Gladwell sums it up with. Brian Williams remembered a traumatic event one way. Then a couple years later, he started remembering that same event a different way. The assumption of virtually everyone who weighed in on the case was this: if someone changes their original story, then they must be lying. The change must be deliberate and self-aggrandizing. Everyone assumes memory is a kind of timestamp video of what happened in your life, and that if you contradict the evidence of the video, you're up to no good. I'm sorry, but that's insane. And it is insane. Transient. Time blurs our memories. They erode, and outside influences come and shape the way we remember things. And of course, that is open to some severe consequences. The malleability of our memories means that they're vulnerable to error and change. And sometimes it's just like, hey, this is what it means to be human, you know? I mean, sometimes people ask me when I tell stories if I'm remembering them correctly because they tend to be a little odd. And I'm like, well, that's just how I remember it, you know? They get bigger over time. But the thing is, sometimes this can be very dangerous, and I want to explore that next week with the church. When memories get distorted, the consequences that has. I mean, consider the case of a woman named Jennifer, and her full story is fascinating. I'm going to unpack it more next week. But she was a woman who was assaulted at knife point when she was in university. And during this traumatic event, she disciplined herself to focus on the perpetrator's details so that she could one day pick him out of a lineup. And when she finally had the chance to do that, she confidently identified Ronald Cotton from a series of photographs and from a lineup. Trial ensued. He was found guilty, spent 11 years in prison until DNA proved that he was not, in fact, the perpetrator, but it was somebody else. And it's not an isolated case. And you see, this is the interesting thing about the way memory morphs. The real perpetrator was never put in front of Jennifer. The only thing she had in front of her was photos of others. So the suggestibility, the prompting of other photos made her memory morph, and then she confidently picks the wrong person. And he spends 11 years in jail, and then is freed. There's more to her story. We'll get to that next week, but this is not alone. As of November 2019, 367 people have been exonerated from prison for serious crimes. Most of them, the average they've spent in jail is 14 years. And when asked why that many people had to be exonerated by DNA, Gary Wells says this: three-quarters of these convictions were based almost entirely on eyewitness testimony that was mistaken. Hundreds of studies have shown one of the most unreliable things there is eyewitness testimony, people who think they remember what they saw. Why? Because memory is malleable. It's open to error and to change. In fact, it's so bad that we can actually create entirely false memories. I came across this story this week, fascinating to me. Story of Benjamin Wilkomirski. Wrote a book called Fragments. It's his memoir of the Holocaust. And in it, he recalls raw, vivid recollections of the unspeakable terrors he witnessed as a boy imprisoned at Auschwitz. In the book, he talks about how repressed these memories were and that they came to light in therapy. And the book became a huge hit, made him a well-known speaker. He became a hero to Holocaust survivors. But unfortunately, none of his Holocaust memories actually happened. A Swiss journalist, himself a Holocaust survivor, published this investigative article that revealed that he actually grew up in a Swiss orphanage. He was in an orphanage and was only after the war that he was adopted into a family. And so what his investigation revealed is something traumatic happened, possibly at the orphanage, but it certainly wasn't in Auschwitz or a concentration camp. It was quite simply never there. But he insists to this day he was there. And so you have these conflicting stories. I mean, it's one of those things you go, what do you do with that? Like Brian Williams, is he a liar looking for attention, or does the mind play tricks? The mind can create false narratives. Leading memory researcher Julia Shaw suggests that based on her research, our memories are so malleable that almost all of us have memories of events that didn't happen, which blows my mind. Kind of disturbing to me. It's also incredibly fascinating. How much about what we assume about ourselves and our past is actually true? And this interests me as a curiosity To me, it's something I could marvel about for hours. But where it really interests me is this. Jesus asked us to remember one thing. And within the pages of the New Testament, we find a church that within a single generation had so lost proper memory of what the cross event was about that their practice of remembering looked nothing like what Jesus had in mind. And that's what I want to focus on coming up next week, with the possibility, the passage of time, with outside influences, the memory of Jesus' cross has become undistinguishable in some circles. And I find it troubling that this event we've been asked to remember has become so layered and has come to mean so many things that I'm not sure it actually means. And of course, I'm one person. I'm open to error as well. But what I want to do next week is really try to dust this off. What does this thing mean, and how do we remember it well? I'm going to ask the band to come as we close here. I fear for the church today. I fear that the one thing Jesus asked us to remember has become lost, so morphed by external forces that we've lost the significance of what it was all about. But I remain convinced to this day it is the most extraordinary, revolutionary event in the history of humanity. And in order to live well in the present and into the future, we've got to get the past right. Again, it's going to be a teaching that I'm going to get passionate about. But Jesus asked us to remember one thing. I just wanted to lay sort of some bare memory stuff before us this morning and say, memory is malleable. Memory fades. And if we're not careful as a church, we're going to end up losing the core of that. We need to protect that. Our identity and trajectory, I think, as a community will always be dependent upon the power of memory. The past informs our present, which informs our future. If we mess up the past, our present and future become distorted as well.